session number 273400 6.
Frank Biggs, reel 6.
It may one proud to be very to being in the Navy. We went ashore, Charlie Best and myself, and the welcome's just the same. Posters displayed, welcome to the victorious Allied fleet. And we were then part of the 6th Fleet. And we then took a rickshaw on to drive round the streets. Youngsters cheered and clapped their hands with delight as we passed. The one thing which got me confused was the currency. And I remember going ashore, and we went, I don't know what the name of the hotel was, but it was very, very nice. And I had a cold dish comprising beef, pork, polony, beetroot, potatoes, tomatoes and lettuce. Sort of a glorified hors d'oeuvre, I should have thought. But what intrigued me, of course, was the fact that you at home were rationed, and Shanghai had apparently been occupied by the Japanese for goodness knows how long, and yet there's all this food available, and that was only the first course. We then went on to soup, followed by a lovely piece of fried fish. I don't know what the fish was. And then we had a course of pork rissoles, and then came the main course: chicken, potatoes, pumpkin and tomatoes. Wound the meal up with ice cream and iced coffee. And for the three of us, it cost in Chinese currency, including tips, $280,000. And that was about 9 shillings. And that was three of us. And that included tips. Fascinating.
What was your impressions of Shanghai as you'd ridden through in that?
Oh, absolutely fascinating. A bit pongy, smelly in parts, and very busy. But of course, no sort of motor transport at all. Trams, and of course, we were anchored in the middle of the river, Yangtze Kaiyan. And that's, of course, a filthy river. And we had sampans pulled up at the side of the ship, and we'd two women that just got the food out of the gas chute and took it on board and ate it. And to clean it or to wash it, they put it in the Wang Pool, which was terribly filthy. And I mean, sewage was passing in it, but they were immune to it all. So there we are. Went to a dance there, and you could have a hostess for the whole night for £69,600. I must sort of point out that this was for dancing, no other reason. But but in view of the fact she didn't speak English, you couldn't strike up a very sensible conversation. But the dance band was quite good and sort of seemed to be able to play up-to-date tunes.
How surprised were you about the situation in Shanghai? Because obviously you mentioned earlier on that there was a plentiful supply of food, mm-hmm. and that you'd been under rationing while you were in England. Mm-hmm. How did it strike you? Was there much signs of the Japanese occupancy?
No, none at all. There was a point when, whilst we were in Shanghai, we all obviously had visits from various people wanting us to supply us with food, food, and it had to be fresh food. We weren't interested in buying anything else. And we got quite friendly with the man who, I seem to remember his name was Mr. Lee. Very nice man, and he was sort of a merchant. And It took a party of us ashore, and we were able to. I bought a dressing gown, a Chinese silk dressing gown. I bought two actually, and I bought one for a friend of mine on the ship to send to his girlfriend, and I sent this to Joyce. And What was surprising about Shanghai, it seemed unaffected by the war. But I've since read in the Daily Telegraph that one of the education writer in the Daily Telegraph, he was actually in there, he lived there as a child. And of course, he's no recollection of having been there, but he knew he was there. And he was flown home from Shanghai by the American forces.
You said about there Mr. Lee was supplying you with food.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any kind of precautions you would take with food? Obviously mentioning the conditions that you'd seen in Shanghai. I know you had to be fresh, but would you inspect?
Well, basically, the chief cook was responsible for that. But there was never any indication that there was anything at all wrong with it. You know, the fresh food was potatoes and with stewardship and vegetables. And there was never any suggestion that there would be anything untoward in any sort of carrying disease. But there were very, very good supplies, which must have come from inland of Shanghai somewhere.
What about meat on board the ship? Where did you carry that from?
Meat was all in refrigerated ice compartments, really. And the butcher used to go down at specified times to get it up so that it would thaw out so he could issue it the next morning for the dinner, which is at midday, no matter what the meat was, be it pork.
With something like that on board the Belfast, how long could you go with the frozen meat? How long would the ship be able to, what kind of duration of patrol or whatever could it do with that fresh meat before you need to reprovision?
Well, the longest we had at sea was 16 days.
But would you have reprovisioned with meat in, say, Shanghai, or would that have been a problem?
No, it wasn't a problem because we had sufficient meat aboard to take us back to... in my recollection, I don't recall us ever having bought meat other than from a storeship. One storeship in mid-ocean, the storeship came alongside and we fired across a pulley arrangement, and we stored ship from this storeship in mid-ocean. And quite honestly, I know we're in the Pacific, obviously, but I've no idea at what point we did it.
Is there anything else that occurred while you were in Shanghai that springs to mind?
Whilst storing ship at Shanghai, we had to vet all the potential suppliers, one of which I particularly remember. We ordered some potatoes, not a large quantity, but he agreed to supply them at whatever price it was, and I can't remember what it was. And Chief said to me, Briggsy said, just get a weighing scale, and he said, just weigh those that have come aboard. And I did. And most of them were well underweight. So consequently, we said thank you very much to this Chinese supplier, but no thank you, we don't want you to supply because you've shown soldiers less than we were supposed to get. So goodbye. He argued and said it wasn't his fault, but we knew that it was.
How would payment be made to them?
It was paid through the Commander S, which was Commander Knott, and he supplied the cheque and he approved the account and who the supplier was, which had to be done. And it was effectively paid physically by the Chief Petty Officer, who was responsible for the supply, and of course the warrant officer, Mr. Deavy.
And you obviously mentioned, or you touched on it, that accurate records were important to be kept at this point. Mm. Who would keep the records of any such transactions?
The transactions, as far as I recall, from a monetary point of view, were taken by the Lieutenant Supply Solomon and, of course, Commander S. Knott. They supervised anything connected with money, really. Although a float was kept by us in the Victualling Office, because we had to take money for any slops that were issued, which, to people that don't know, slops mean clothing. And of course they pay cash. In the Navy, the crew get paid, including a clothing allowance, and therefore they're able to buy whatever clothing they need and pay cash for it at a clothing issue store, which we were responsible for.
Can you explain the slop system and how that works?
Well, the slop system is a straightforward matter, really, of getting a slop chit from the Victualling Office, or more likely the clothing store, prior to the issue, and then the rating, who wants whatever he wants, writes on the slop chit his requirements, anything from hats to suits to shirts to collars to anything connected with the uniform at all, including underwear, socks, shoes. And they write this slop chit out, and clothing store supply them with, and there's a store full of various, not all sort of catalogued and shelved and listed, and we know exactly how much there is and where it is, and it's issued at some time whilst at sea, or indeed in dock should that be necessary.
And how are the slops acquired?
They're acquired from the shore establishment, or from a ship if you store in ship. But you keep that down to a minimum, because food's more important than uniform. But I've no recollection of us ever having run out of any single item of clothing, or, but then we'd a lot to start from.
So while you're in Shanghai, you were experiencing China for the first time. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that struck you while you were there as quite new?
In the first instance, we were the first British ship in Shanghai, and of course that meant that we were sort of we were the first ship, and therefore the Chinese hadn't got used to us, we hadn't got used to them, but they were very friendly, we were very friendly to them, had a super time. I remember going to see I think it was the Roxy, the cinema's called, and we saw In Which We Serve, which is Noel Coward's film, which presumably had been flown out there, and we saw it, and as we came out, there were literally hundreds of rickshaws waiting to take us back to the ship. And we obviously paid them, but the rate of currency was such that you'd virtually give them a bundle of notes, and you know, you haven't given them much, but the Chinese were quite happy to take it. But of course the situation changed somewhat the second time we got back to Shanghai, by which time the Americans had virtually taken charge of it in our absence, and this of course was and of course with the intervention of the Americans, the cost of living, if that's what I should call it, had gone up tremendously, and virtually the Americans had taken charge At one point, it was suggested that we should send a landing party ashore in Shanghai in the first instance, but this was later cancelled. And it was obvious by the time we got back to Shanghai in September, December, which, having spent Christmas in Hong Kong, the situation was quite different to the one that we enjoyed when we first visited Shanghai.
You said you spent the Christmas in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like?
Well, we spent the Christmas in Hong Kong, which was very good because we had a Christmas dinner, obviously, on board, which was the turkey and the trimmings, and sort of captains got dressed up in ratings clothes. Well, I don't think that happened, but a lot of the officers did, and swapped uniforms, and a good time was had by all. And it was... It's not very clear in my mind as to what happened, really. Can you just... We arrived in Hong Kong for Christmas, and at Xmas Day, I wrote a letter home, and because we were resting after a marvellous dinner, we had just the usual Christmas meal, and even had cigars. And quite honestly, I don't remember where they came from or to whom they were given and for what reason, but there we are, we had cigars. And I recall that we had a damage control exercise, and during this, one of the watchmen on duty saw a mine floating quite close to the ship, and we got near enough to it to fire rifle shots at it, and I got in the queue for it, but before I was able to take a pot shot at it as a volunteer, they decided to sink it by the Oerlikon gun, and that was it. But quite an experience. And then eventually we returned to Sydney, during which time I spent time with some people called Elliot, who were related to our local postmaster in Eccleshill. So I had quite a pleasant time in Sydney, sort of quite a lot of it. And as it was February, the weather was quite pleasant, and I had a really grand time. And after that, of course, we went on our cruise. We went to from Sydney. We went to Port Chalmers in New Zealand, and following that we went up to Wellington and just stayed at Wellington a short time to store ship and refuel. And then we went to Wellington Napier, and I think it was at Napier where we went ashore to a Maori village, and there a group of us, including Bert Knowles, Ron Burrows, Peter Clayton, and I'm not certain what happened to my friend, who is now a member of the Belfast Association, called Eddie Porter. I'd forgotten about his existence until I read his name there. And I traced back through various letters I had from home that we went ashore a considerable number of occasions. And at some time in the future, I think I might give him a ring. But I'm not sure that Eddie actually went ashore at the same time as the people who I've mentioned. However, he might hear this sometime in the future, or indeed he might hear me on the telephone.
You went ashore to a Maori village?
Yes, indeed. We went to a Maori village where the wonderful people gave us a concert in the village hall, and singing was really marvellous. The first anthem was derived from the hymn Onward Christian Soldiers, and that followed by a Maori marching song. The last was their best effort of three vocal items. They sung they'll always be in England. And the next item was young Maoris who sang in their own language and two popular dance tunes. Wait Until the Sun Shines in LA and the Maori Farewell Song. And that was followed by the National Anthem. We said goodbye and enjoyed ourselves very much. And later on, whilst in the area, I remember going to a walk on the cliffs, and it appears that the entire town was attacked by an earthquake in 1931. Another part of the town was just wasteland, but now they are irrigating it and making it into farms for the returned servicemen. Bert Knowles and I went ashore again on Monday, and after a jolly good dinner we walked around and met Eddie Porter and went to Hastings to the pictures. It's quite a small town with but has three cinemas, and it was quite a good show. And on Tuesday morning, much to everyone's regret, it was time to leave, and the mayor and the town clerk came down to ask the captain if he could stay for a few more days. But even the captain, as much as he would have liked to stay, could not prolong our visit. And then we went on to Suva in the Fiji Isles.
How did you get along with the New Zealanders?
Very well. I mean, the men are very welcome, you see, and they had a dance, went to a dance hall, and they were very friendly. And I think somewhere, the Lord Mayor, or the Mayor, was down to Baker's.
So what was Suva like?
Well, it was very pleasant. Of course, it was unspoilt then. The tourists hadn't arrived, and which sort of just basically went for walks.
How did you feel about this? Because now, obviously, the war's ended. You're having quite a nice cruise around parts of the world you might not have seen prior to the war.
Well, this is what I think. I mean, one of the things that brought to light, going back over these notes, is the fact that at the time I was moaning a bit about getting out. And I realise now that this was a once-in-a-lifetime experience that I would... Sorry. And then from Suva, we sort of went for walks, but there was not much else to do. But I do recall that the Fijian football team played our football team, and one of our lads had his leg broken, and the Fijian football team didn't even wear boots. They played in bare feet. So there we are.
Did they abide by the rules?
As far as I can recall, yes. Yeah. I didn't actually see them. I think I was on duty that particular time. But we had some nice meals in Suva, and people bought various things, such as... one of the things, of course, for stamp collectors, they all swarmed into the post office as soon as we got ashore. Otherwise, there were various souvenirs where shops selling coral of various colours, but I didn't bother buying any because, well, I just didn't bother wanting any. But it was nice to go and nice to see it, and it's a lovely sort of reminds you of Dorothy Lamour in The Hurricane sort of place, really. Palm trees and a very laid-back way of life, and the Fijian policeman in the skirts, which was quite nice to see, and lovely people. There were then, it seems that, like the rest of the world, it's deteriorated for one reason or another.
So where did you go to after you left Fiji?
We went from Suva to Yokohama, and this was quite interesting. Whilst we were at Yokohama, we did, of course, go to Tokyo, which I think is about 20-odd miles away from Yokohama. And, of course, we got on the train, and for reasons that I can't remember, any British servicemen were put in separate compartments to any Japanese. And we travelled to Tokyo, and... really, the Japanese were most kind almost, really, very withdrawn, and they were also, we were also restricted on where we could go. I managed to go into the gardens of the emperor, and we're quite free. And one of the things that the Japanese did ask us for, have you got any cigarettes? But by and large, we went for a meal at an hotel in Tokyo, and whilst we were waiting for a meal, we were sitting in the lounge of this hotel. I think there were three or four of us, and going in memory, there was Bert Knowles, Eddie Porter, myself, and possibly others. And this gentleman came up to us and started chatting about it. He said, well, I'd like to speak to you, chaps. He said, would you like to come to my room? And it turned out to be a judge from New Zealand who was on the war tribunal for investigating into war crimes in Tokyo. And he asked us quite a lot of questions. We were served tea and cakes, I think, which were very, was very pleasant. And I think we spent about two hours with him, just chatting amongst ourselves. And he thanked us very much for being so pleasant, and told him a lot about what we knew, which wasn't very much, really, other than experiences. And I must admit, I've forgotten his name, but it was quite an experience. And I think we were in that area for quite some time. And then, of course, from there, we went from Yokohama to the Inland Sea, which was a marvellous experience at that time of year. And it was quite incredible to see the cherry blossom on the Inland Sea, growing right down to the shoreline, a wonderful experience. And from Kyure, we went on to Kobe. And I can't remember, without reference to diaries, whether it was Kyure or Kobe, which had been heavily bombed by normal bombs, or conventional bombs, by the Americans. And I recall standing with my friends at one side of the town and seeing complete devastation right through to the other. And this wasn't the atom bomb, this was conventional bombing. And we had, whilst in Yokohama, had opportunity, or the chance, to go to Nagasaki to see the damage done by the atom bomb. But quite honestly, I freaked out of it. I didn't really want to see the devastation. In some ways, I now regret it, because it was all part of experience. But no, I just didn't want to see it.
How much did the attitude of the Japanese surprised you when you actually got there? Because you sounded like you were a little bit surprised that they were so kind and quiet, withdrawn, that sort of thing, after what you'd learned of them.
I think that the Japanese attitude was such that we were really the victorious army. And from that point of view, they admired us. I couldn't give any logical explanation as to why we found them like that. At times, you came to the conclusion that they were trying to be subservient in some respect towards us. Rather sort of, we now like you because we can't do any other. But whether that was true or not, but because of the fact that none of them spoke English or understood English, so it was very difficult to understand them, other than the fact that they came from the point of view of a kamikaze pilot, that you'll kill yourself for the sake of your country. Well, it's a bit different sort of putting your life online than it is sort of committing suicide for it. But we never really understood them. When they were on board the ship, they were always very willing workers, and if you sort of pointed at them, you could shout at them, you could put a smile on your face and call them all sorts of rude names and just smile back. They were sort of good workers, and you couldn't fault them in that respect at all.